This episode is brought to you in part by Aftershock Comics and their new young adult imprint, Seismic Press. Be sure to check out all the wonderful things coming down the pipe there, possibly starting with this comic right here.
I'm Anthony Bachman from All Things Good and Nerdy, a geeky podcast, part of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other fantastic geeky shows at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And welcome to Play Comics, where once again we are just going to forget about the whole video game thing and talk about some cool stuff that got made by some cool people. Today we are talking to Steve and Steve. They have last names, but I think it's more fun to say it this way. But really, it's Steve Fox and Steve Orlando. And how are you two today?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me on.
Same, yeah. Thanks for having us to talk about the book.
Well, I'm glad that you guys have had a good day and stuff so far, because now we're going to completely ruin that, because we are talking about your book, Rainbow Bridge, and how I got all the way to page 20 or 21 before I started to cry.
Better than us, and we wrote it, so.
Yeah, Steve Orlando and I both, when we were doing the final lettering pass, realized that we were making ourselves emotional, which is probably like a little impolite to admit, but when we read it back, we're like, oh, feelings.
I hadn't felt them in a while anyway, so I was thankful for it.
Well, I'm glad we could put feelings back into your life. It's been a crazy 12 years this past year, I think is how it worked out.
Yeah, give or take a dozen there. Time has no meaning.
So, as I said, we are looking at Rainbow Bridge, which is a book that you two have written about a boy and his final adventure with his dog. And just a warning for everybody, we are recording this live from the Onion Cutting Factory, and I am not editing any of that out.
I've actually really had to, like, remind or inform people that while the story does have a sad genesis, it is ultimately like a hopeful, fun adventure story, because I noticed I kept getting tweets that were like, oh, this looks so good, I could never read it. And I was like, oh, no, please buy this and read it. I promise it's not Where the Red Fern Grows or Old Yeller or anything like that. We wring the emotion out of you, but then it's very much an adventure and an epic story and fun and one last go, not just sobbing for 120 pages.
And it really is worth all of it at the end, though. I thought I was going to have to spread this out over a couple nights reading it, and I ended up just reading it all in one night. I had no choice. I couldn't stop.
Yeah, well, we're also very lucky working with, like, the art team we worked with. I feel like it has the very propulsive feel of, like, an animated movie, which gets used probably too much when talking about comics, but with Valentina and Manuel and Haas's work, like, it kind of feels like it's dragging you along for the ride, or bringing you along for the ride. I guess dragging has a negative connotation, but carrying you along for the ride. So it feels like a big adventure movie, and you can kind of ignore the fact that you're crying in the beginning and maybe you cry again at the end because you're having fun in between.
That's a much nicer version that Fox says, you know, like, I think last time we did this call, I was like, even the mom dies at the beginning of Bambi. So, like, which is true, by the way, I guess spoilers for a 50-year-old movie. But, we wanted to do this version of sort of our first middle grade story that combines my aesthetic and Fox's aesthetic. The things that interest us and you know, the animated films and the stories from our youth that I think appealed to us, they of course end in a happy place, but they were challenging, you know? Like, I joked about Bambi there, but the first movie I ever saw in theaters was The Land Before Time. And when I was a kid, super kid. And, you know, like, his parents get killed by Sharptooth in the beginning. Like, a lot of these seminal works, you know, they're not there to terrorize, but they are there, you know, so many formational and foundational stories for young adults are about dealing with, you know, some sort of life-altering trauma. And that's what I think, you know, in, again, in a hopeful way, we wanted to engage here, because that's what being a teenager is. You know, you find out, you reckon with your loss of innocence in any number of ways. And, you know, we're here to say that in this particular case, it can work out, and it can be a moment to grow and memorialize what's happened in the past and come out at the other end positive.
Yeah, and I guess also we should say explicitly, Rainbow Bridge is about a boy and his dog. I can't recall if that got said yet, because just hearing Steve talk about it could be like any form of grief or trauma or all sorts of horrible things. So to clarify, because also one of my very close friends who I speak to every day just realized today that Rainbow Bridge referred to the pet afterlife. And he texted me, he's like, wait, does the corgi die? I was like, dude, the book opens with the corgi having already passed away. Like, the dog is dead when we begin, and then it's an afterlife adventure. So yeah, Steve and I had both dealt with loss of pets, which I'm sure a lot of people unfortunately have similar experiences. And we're both dog people now. He has a corgi, I have a chihuahua mix. So we're bringing a lot of our own pet experience and dog experience to the table, and trying to make it like a universal story that is appropriate for younger ages. But if you're an older person who's dealt with the loss of an animal, you know, it's gonna like slap you right back down to those raw, vulnerable younger years.
So what made y'all want to tell this story now?
Well, so Steve Orlando had the original germ of the idea. We've collaborated on a couple different things together now, and each collaboration, a couple of which have been announced and some haven't, have come about in totally different ways. But Steve does sometimes just kind of think of log lines or like elevator pitches, and he'll text them to me of like, is this anything? Is this something we would run with? And with Rainbow Bridge, I think it was, Steve, how did you first describe it? I feel like it had Conan or something else going on.
No, I sent you two. I sent you two things that night. One was Starship Potemkin, Battleship Potemkin in space, and then the other was, what if the Bifrost was the Rainbow Bridge? Or excuse me, what if the Rainbow Bridge was the Bifrost? And despite being a connoisseur of Russian cinema, you gravitated towards the other concept, which is how we kick this off. You know, after that little core, you know, you sprinkled your water on it and it turned into a book over the course of 2 years, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. I remember I went to Conan because in a very earlier version of Rainbow Bridge, one of the first images that kind of coalesced was a boy riding a corgi, like a war steed. And I think at one point we'd even talked about like armor or other sort of accoutrements for Rocket, which didn't end up gelling with the final version of the book. But there was an earlier version of this that could have been a darker edge to it, a more adult story, more along the lines of like The Neverending Story or some of the 80s family movies that were truly like all ages, no punches pulled. But we ended up feeling like this was skewing a little younger, and that's where it really needed to sit in the end. So yes, it started with Rainbow Bridge as Bifrost and took a winding road to being the first Seismic Press title from Aftershock.
I think it's a wonderful one for them to start out on. I mean, anything I have told anybody about this is like, you have to read it and make sure your pet is with you so you can just give them a big hug, but you definitely have to read it.
Yeah, when we, so the day we had to approve the final lettering draft, I was at the vet with my dog having like a more intensive dental procedure, and she's totally fine. And Steve was at the vet with his dog, who had had some nerve issues. So we were both like on our phones at the vet reviewing this lettering pass, thinking like, this has gotten too real. We just need to get our dogs home. And they're both fine now.
I think that's the most important part of the whole story, is that both of the dogs are fine now. Everybody needs to have their fuzzy friends, so they just make the world a lot much better place.
Or feathered, or scaled, or, you know, what have you. When you see the Forever Fields in the book, The Pet Afterlife, you know, we got to see all sorts of animals. And there were some even that Valentina ended up putting in there at first, where I was like, I think this kind of qualifies as an exotic pet at this point. But we made it work in the confines of the story.
How much freedom did you give Valentina on this one?
I mean, I would say, I mean, Chris, I think you've talked to me, you know, before, and folks know, like, I'm a strong proponent of giving your co-creators as much freedom as possible, you know, which is not to say, oh, we don't like to do anything on the writing side, but it is to say that these people are, you know, especially on an original concept, they're co-creators. They don't work for me and Fox. You know, they're part of the team and an essential part of the team. So I, you know, to my recollection, which Steve can jump in and squash if he likes, like, we gave them, you know, we told Valentina that it was, you know, this was a fantasy world that was born out of, like, images that dogs and pets would react to, you know, like the architecture of a pet playroom. But beyond that, you know, we wanted her to run wild as much as possible because she's a co-creator on this book as well. And that goes not just for her, but for Manuel and for Hassan, who, like, really surprised me a lot of times with his take on the lettering in a great way. But again, like, I step back. We work with these people because they're great at what they do. And so only, you know, only a jerk would step in and try to micromanage that. Like, if we pick people that we knew would deliver, and then our job is to give them a story that gets the best work out of them, and then get the hell out of the way. That's my take.
Get the heck out of the way, because this is an all ages book. But yeah, no, Steve's right. I think at default, he and I both usually prefer to work in, like, full scripts. Like, we don't leave too much up to total chance, but the assumption is always that our collaborators are going to bring their own spin to things and bring their own perspective to things. And that was certainly the case with Rainbow Bridge. There was really no hand-holding with Valentina. She got the aesthetic of the world that we were thinking right off the bat, and added things that, you know, Steve and I hadn't thought up ourselves that really brought the whole place together. So I know, like, when Steve mentioned the or Steve Orlando mentioned the Pet Afterlife and kind of the design and the thinking behind that. And we always made suggestions, but Valentina added so many things to each of those scenes. If she wasn't Italian, we would probably do all of these calls and interviews with her, but she's in a very different time zone than the rest of us, and speaks another language than the rest of us. But it was a very fun, seamless collaboration. Of the ones that Steve and I have done together, this was one that probably clicked into place the quickest on the art side. Like, Valentine and Manuel just got it. And once they had turned in that first chapter, I think we both realized that, like, trying to have a heavier hand would only slow them down or make things worse, because they were just doing it on their own and did not need any additional say-so from us.
How much of y'all's own personal stories, if you don't mind sharing, if this isn't a horrible question, did you manage to get into the book?
Well, a fun trivia fact, the main character is named Andy because both Steve Orlando and I, our middle names are Andrew. So we did choose that. I can say from my end, this doesn't necessarily reflect any specific pet journeys I've had, but one thing I did put in there that definitely feels like a Fox touchstone is Andy's parents rescue senior and differently abled dogs, and that's a big passion of mine. And my parents, for the past decade, they don't run a sanctuary or anything, but they've only adopted senior animals and terminally ill animals. And my first animal that I adopted myself as an adult was a senior who was living with cancer, so I wanted to make sure that was put in there to show the nicer side of the twilight years, and that animals have worth and value and love to give, even when the circumstances are kind of stacked against them a bit. And Steve Orlando has a corgi, so that made its way in.
Well, I was going to say, the things like, so my story, I mean, like, is a little less on display here than Fox's, just because he is a much more empathetic person than me. But I will say, like, a large part of why the lead is a corgi and why this book came to pass comes from my background in folklore. Like, Steve was saying, oh, one of the original things we thought about was someone riding a corgi like Battle Cat, and that did not come to pass. But I do know that in mythology, corgis are, obviously, you know, it's just folklore, but they're thought of as being the steeds for these fairy warriors, and the white part of their fur over their shoulders is thought to be the saddle. You know, this is just like a fun little bit of folklore that surrounded them. So because that's what I studied in college, I always sort of gravitate towards elements like that. So while my own personal journey isn't as on display in the story as Fox's, my interests are right there. You know, like, and that's not even, that's notwithstanding the fact that the Rainbow Bridge itself is a part of modern folklore, you know, in the current zeitgeist. So we came at it from different angles with our interests and experiences, but both of us are there in every page in our own way.
I had not heard that about corgis at all. Is that Celtic stuff?
I mean, they're Welsh, so I mean, out of my ass, I'm going to say that it's Welsh folklore. You know, I have not. Guess what? This podcast is not all ages.
Out of your butt.
And kids need to learn that the word ass exists. but anyway. Yeah, I would have to, you know, when we decided that we were going a little bit more in the All Dogs Go to Heaven route, I sort of put a pin in that for free time that I didn't have, or still don't have, Chris, but I would guess it's Welsh, for all of the Occam's Razor reasons with corgis, at least in this case, it being a Pembroke Welsh corgi, that's the lead of the book.
Hey, it works for me, but I'm definitely going to have to go look into that later, because I'm just trying to get into more folklore stuff. I just think it's a fascinating thing that my schooling never got me too much experience in. And that's horrible.
Well, if you'd gone to a bougie liberal arts college, you could have taken, you could have majored in Russian folklore like me and really put that degree to use.
I went to Winthrop, I got a completely useless psychology degree, so that probably would have been better. What's been the general reaction from people? I know the book came out today in comic stores, and it's coming out in the next couple weeks to regular bookstores. So you're going to have a pretty wide range of people who are able to see it. But what have you heard so far from everyone?
Any way you want to get it, August is the month to do it. Well, actually, like I said earlier, it's been funny to see a lot of people say, oh, I'm like, this looks like it's going to make me cry. I don't know if I can read this. And then me realizing after like the 10th or 15th time, like, oh, I really got to start convincing people to read this despite the emotions. But it's been nice and also a bit emotional to see some of the early reviews that did come out today. People talk about their own pets that they've lost, or, you know, their own sort of animal related grief they've had, and how this book helped put that into perspective and put a hopeful spin onto it, which is really like the nicest possible thing we could hear. It's also always nice to hear from kids, and one of the Aftershock colleagues we work with emailed us to say that one of her friend's sons read it twice already and loved it, and, you know, just wanted more. So it's always nice to hear from like the actual younger audience. But the wider release is actually very important to something like this, because as much as we want to see more kids going into comic shops, a lot of younger readers and a lot of their parents who are actually buying the books don't. So making sure that this and the other Seismic Press titles make it to bookstores and make it to other places really helps the accessibility of the title and really helps make sure that the intended audience gets their hands on it. And my boyfriend, who is quite the critic of my own work, he read it yesterday for the first time finally, and he approved and thought it was one of his favorite things that I've written. So it was nice to get the Junie stamp of approval. It doesn't come easily. He wanted more Chihuahua, though.
Was that his choice or yours waiting so long?
Mine. I wanted to wait for him to be able to read it in a hard copy, so I gave it to him once I got my comps. But yeah, his biggest criticism was that there's only one scene with a Chihuahua.
But we'll fix that in the sequel.
Is there going to be a sequel? You can't just throw that out there like that and tease me.
Well, I mean, with anything, Chris, it depends on how the book does. But if you're asking if we have ideas for a sequel, absolutely. You know, like, we would love to see the next adventure. Can we do that? It's an unromantic answer, but everything in comics just comes down to, did this sell enough for a sequel? But if Aftershock wants to continue, trust me and Fox, we will be there. We already know where we'd go. So there'd be little problem delivering that.
Yeah, we're not being coy. There's not a second one, you know, waiting to be revealed, but we would love to do it. Our approach to ending this one, I always say, is like the original Star Wars movie, where it certainly doesn't wrap everything up, but if you never get any more, it is a conclusion. You know, I hope readers won't feel like they didn't get an end to the story, but they'll certainly see that there's more to come if we get a chance to do it.
And I'm sure your ideas are full of redacted and redacted with redacted all over the place.
Yes.
I'm not even going to ask about that.
But I can say there will be more chihuahuas if we get to do it.
But what about cats? Because that's what I have. And I mean, your cat representation in here was good, but it was also like higher level side character.
Hey, you get a very old cat and you get some young cats. So we gave you a range of cats. She has a pun name. So I think the cat quality was pretty high in the book. I'm a big cat person myself too. My left arm is all cat tattoos. My dogdom really came in the last couple years when I met my boyfriend and met his dog. So if we get a sequel, I think the range of animals will even itself out a little bit. And I'm sure you'll get some more cats, you'll get more of Padre Hepburn, and who knows what else? Maybe a turtle, why not?
Oh, I'm gonna think of some really strange pets that we can put in there, but that's for the sequel. You know, just an ocean full of the of like goldfish number one through goldfish number seven that I had as a kid.
And you're gonna give them all punny names, right? Please.
The puns come from Fox, so you'd have to talk to him.
Yeah, I remember when I wrote the Padre Hepburn name in there, Steve was like, okay, but what are we really going to call her? I was like, no, that one's final.
Please don't tell me you had to fight for that, because that was such a good touch.
I mean, to be clear, everything is a fight between me and Fox. Let's just make that clear. We're fighting. We're teeing up the next fight right now. But you guys all benefit, right? So it's totally fine. Yeah. No. I mean, I just feel like we need maybe like a Truman Capote pun animal to balance out the Audrey Hepburn pun for the next one. We have at least a year to think about that, so we can deliver.
And what was it like making this for a new imprint on a fairly established publisher?
Well, you know, Steve Orlando can correct me if I'm wrong, but I actually don't think we knew about Seismic Press when Rainbow Bridge was signed up. It was a little later into development that Aftershock let us know that they were going to be launching a dedicated imprint and that they wanted to lead with Rainbow Bridge, because they've done a couple of books before that were intended for all ages, like Lollipop Kids, that are now getting reissued as Seismic Press. But when we first pitched it to them, I don't think we knew, did we, Steve?
Yeah, you know, to be completely honest, and if you're listening or you end up listening to Aftershock, have fun with this, but like, we actually pitched them, I'm sure they were thinking about it in some form before, but Seismic came from how strong we pitched the need for a book like Rainbow Bridge. I mean, I remember sitting with you, Fox, at dinner after New York, where we were deciding not just if we could do Rainbow Bridge, but if we could, you know, float, not we as us and Aftershock were deciding if they could float an imprint with this at the forefront. So I think, you know, in the decision to make Rainbow Bridge what it was for middle grade readers versus more like a never ending story thing, that was sort of intrinsically woven into the question of, do we want to kick off this young adult imprint. So, you know, I'm just gonna put us over hard in this and say that, you know, a lot of Seismic, I don't know, I'm sure Seismic would have happened, of course, in time, but I think we did sort of throw gasoline on the fire. We need to get this going now because we delivered a pitch that was just, you know, right in the strike zone for how you kick off a young adult imprint. I remember having the discussions about whether it was something that they wanted to move forward with, and you're so seductive and persuasive that we got it over the plate.
Yeah, no, Aftershock was definitely very supportive of the idea right off the bat. They liked this quite a bit, and I am now accessing my my memory vaults and remembering them talking to us about how this was kind of like the title they had been looking for to help kick this off. It's also nice because Steve Orlando had an existing relationship with Aftershock, so we were able to come to them with this idea and say, look, we have this idea, and it could be Conan the Barbarian, or it could be Middle Grade, and we feel strongly about it. Where do you see this going? And Mike Martz and Christina Harrington and the rest of the Aftershock staff were very helpful in assembling the right team and getting this on the right track to be the book it is today.
So how far into the process of you making the book did the Seismic decision happen?
Oh, I mean, before we started. but that's only because, like I said, like if they were not going to move forward with that, we probably would have pivoted to the other telling of the story. So we knew what was going to happen, you know, as soon as we kicked off down the road of telling this as a middle grade story.
Yeah, after we pitched, but before the book really got going. It's not like there is a lost, you know, Orlando's cut somewhere where things are violent and terrifying.
But no, there is no secret version that's just full of viscera out there. You know, for that, you can turn to future work coming out from me and Fox that is not set in the Animal Afterlife in October, which we will have out soon. But no, we... you know, the nice thing about the story is that there were many different ways we could deliver it, but as, you know, Steve and I have talked about a lot, like, nothing is compromised in young adult. You got every beat we would have told in the other version. The delivery, you know, the medium and the way we lay it out, of course, changes, but it was my learning experience in doing young adult and being a jerk before and saying, oh, well, you know, we're just doing the sanitized version of this story because I am, in many cases, an idiot. And talking to Fox and learning that no, like, you know, kids want to be not talked down to, they want to read up. So while we could have gone a couple different directions in how the story of Andy and Rocket happened, everything we wanted to do was in every version because the real learning experience in this was me learning about how wide the possibilities of young adult and middle grade truly were, which, as with most things in the entertainment fields, I had to learn on the job. And I did, you know, thanks to the patience and constant attacks of Fox.
Yeah, one of the reasons this was the first thing we've collaborated on is that while my work does span from, you know, razor blades and darker, gorier things to much younger stuff, my primary background is in kids literature. So I was a natural collaborator to help Steve Orlando get his head on straight about middle grade and YA. And especially with a topic like this, which does deal with loss and trauma, kids are feeling that, and they're feeling that in very real, tangible, severe ways. So trying to sand the edges off or talk down to them or make things seem easier or better or simpler than they really are is kind of a recipe for failure in my book. I think that's why a lot of the most powerful kids stories do deal with very adult themes and topics, or very emotionally true themes and topics. They just do so in a way that's not going to completely disturb or alienate or freak out younger kids. So, I mean, my dog that I grew up with passed away when I was 12, I think, and I remember coming home and him not being at the door and just collapsing, like knowing what that meant. So that is a very real, powerful, lasting sort of trauma that kids have to go through. And Rainbow Bridge is our acknowledgement of that, but also our escapist fantasy, celebration of the friendship, adventure epic version of that kind of feeling.
Well, I think y'all pulled it off beautifully. And despite what you said earlier, I'm going to give both of you full credit for making this happen. And Aftershock can just be annoyed at me for saying that.
It was a good case of right place, right time, right pitch. And if you're in a field like comics long enough, sometimes you're lucky to have those, and you also see when it just doesn't happen. So it's nice that it happened with Rainbow Bridge. And then it was very funny too that it was very soon after that Steve and I came back to Aftershock and we're like, hey, we have another idea we feel really strongly about. By the way, it's like a very sexual, very grim, graphic, violent horror thriller. And they approved it. So we were working on both of those books simultaneously. And I think there's even an email from Mike Martz at one point who was like, I got to start reading Party and Pray, then Rainbow Bridge, so I end on a happy note instead of reading Rainbow Bridge and then Party and Pray and just feeling depressed.
How do you flip your head between those two different worlds as you're creating them?
Well, Steve Orlando has a ton of experience in this too, but the reality of a working writer in a field like comics is that you kind of have to be able to shift gears quickly. I mean, certainly a lot of people just stick in kids or in adult, or it might not be quite the tonal whiplash, but if you want to pay the bills and build a future and sustain a career, you have to get good at Tuesday your mind is in the Marvel Universe, Wednesday your mind is in an original fantasy world you created, Thursday, you know, you're working in a kid's book, whatever. And I've had to do that since the beginning of my career because I do a lot of license work. So I go from writing like a Super Mario little golden book for kids to editing Razorblades horror stories that are, you know, decidedly 18 plus. And if you can't figure out how to switch those lanes, this might not be the job for you.
Yeah, I don't think I'd be able to pull that off right now. Totally amazing that you guys can do it, though.
I mean, the dream and privilege is always to work on less and not have to pivot too much, but there's also so much fun in the variety. Like, one of the reasons my bibliography looks as bizarre as it does at times is that I don't really want to give up either side of what I do. I like being able to write for kids and for adults and everyone in between. So as much as there are some days where I wish I could just spend a month in one world, I think I would get bored if I had to choose. And Steve has to do this all the time because he's been juggling, or Steve Orlando, I should clarify, because he's been juggling, you know, quite large responsibilities for years now.
This is something you explained very well, Fox. Like, it is, I distinctly remember actually, when we were younger, there was a Mark Miller interview where he was talking about Ultimates, and he said, and like issue two had just came out, or not even, maybe issue one was out. And he was like, well, I'm so excited about issue 13 that I'm just gonna write that out of order. And as a kid, I was like, man, being a comic writer, you must have so much freedom to just like work on whatever you want. But not everyone is Mark. And yeah, I mean, we gotta hustle a lot of things, you know, and there's a lot of plates in the air at all times for you, for me, and for your favorite writer too. And the reality is, like, yeah, it's not a sexy answer, but it's part of the gig, man. Like, when you catch that plate, you gotta know how to polish it and fill it or whatever metaphor you want, then you toss it back up and you get in the next mindset. I will say though, I try to devote like one stream of thought in a week to one at least single A project, which was a luxury we had on this, so that, you know, yeah, we got to switch maybe every 4 days to something else, you know, but we don't have to switch between the same day of when we're working on in this hypothetical Rainbow Bridge and Party and Pray going from like a you know, an all ages adventure to something straight out of Sleepover Camp, you know, like the but that's all just about knowing the back of the job and knowing how to organize your schedule. And hoping that no one drops a grenade into it, but both of us have turned out to be pretty good at that, or at minimum to pick up the slack when one of us is struggling with it. But that's the beauty of co-writing and quote friendship, which in theory we have.
I will say though, Steve Orlando and I have very different work processes in some ways. Like I know Steve O is very good about like sitting down at a certain time, getting to work, churning it out. I don't say churn in any sort of negative connotation, but like Steve is good about like locking in. And me, I'm more of a like, okay, I'm gonna take a walk around the neighborhood and clear my thoughts and recenter my writing chakras a bit before I can jump into this. So it has been nice to have this tag team experience. Obviously, we both do a lot of stuff where it's just one or the other. But getting to work on these couple books with Steve and some of the other co-writing opportunities I've had and he's had, it's nice to have a partner in this experience. And I certainly get the appeal of, you know, like Jackson and Colin and I was gonna say Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning, but it's been a while. So any of the like great collabs and comics, I understand why some of them really stick. And it's why Steve and I have other projects coming down the pipeline that are announced and that aren't announced.
I mean, and to be clear, we're way nicer to each other than Jackson and Colin, but everything they do to each other and say to each other is out of a place of love. I've seen it firsthand.
And normally this is about where I'd ask about advice you guys have for people getting into comics, but I can't imagine it would have changed much since the last time I talked to either one of you.
I'll be real with you, Chris. It hasn't changed in 35 years.
Don't so, do it.
The access has only gotten easier, actually, in the advent of the internet and crowdfunding and things like that. But yes, you are correct. Like the short version, since you brought it up, is you know find a way to make comics. Start small, get critiques, and do it again, and start the climb. And that can happen in a lot of different ways. Fox's story is not like mine, but each are equally valid. And everybody, you know, it's a cornucopia of anecdotal evidence that nobody gets in the same way. But the one constant is you have to tell complete stories. You have to find collaborators and you have to go out there and get crit and listen to it. That's why you need to get critique from people you respect and like, or at least respect. You don't even have to like them. And you just got to keep honing your craft, and it can take any number of years, or it can take any number of months. You know, like I've, and that's what I would say to people. The keys are make books, start small. Like if people want to see a 10-page story that's complete, versus a 20-page story that's issue one of like a 100-issue thing that may never happen. And be prepared to get critiqued by folks who you value, and you're going to find out what's good about the work, and you're going to find out what could be better. Take that to heart, know that they're trying to help you, and go and implement that for the future. And eventually, you know, you'll get to a spot where your talent and your networking align, which is what happened to me. It took a long time for me, but it doesn't have to. And you'll get your first shot, and then you crush it, and then you keep climbing from there. And know that, you know, this is a business where you're always hustling. Like, and I'm probably a little more cut and dry about it than other people, but I'm on the podcast, not them. Like, every time, you know, it seems like in the rotation of topics on Twitter, you know, how do you know when you've made it is on the pinwheel, along with why doesn't Batman just buy crime, you know? And the fact is you've never made it. Like the minute you think you've made it is when someone is out hustling you. Every creator you know, because we're freelance, is still already considering how they're gonna make money in a year or 2 years. Like maybe the scale is different, but like, so when it comes to breaking into comics and breaking into entertainment, like, you know, it's unromantic, but the answer is you work hard, you learn from your mistakes and you learn from your successes, and you honestly gotta be prepared to do that forever. No one skates, you know, like, and I guess what I'll say is this, like, I'm not burying him to say this, Fox and I are both really close with Tynan, and he's been crushing comics right now, but you know what? Tynan still gets nervous about things. Tynan still has to hustle and sell books. And this is a guy who has, you know, multiple Eisners this year, and it's just crushing the game right now. And that shouldn't be intimidating. It should be comforting to know that if you're in some station of the process, the people that you look up to, they've been there, and maybe they are there, and we're not that far apart as you think. So you can do it. You just got to stay focused, and know that it's a marathon, not a sprint. And that's how I'm here. That's how Fox is here. That's how everyone you love in comics is here. And the future people you're going to love, they're doing the same thing right now. So you can do it too. You just got to put your nose down and be determined.
And the one thing I would add, I agree with everything Steve Orlando just said, but one thing I would add too, you know, I think this past year and a half has inspired a lot of people to kind of pause and take stock of where they are and what they want out of life. And I think that's a perspective that is healthy to have in a field like comics or any creative field. Because a lot of the times when we talk about how to get into comics or how to make it or whatever, and, you know, imagine air quotes around all those words, the assumption is that you want this to be your full-time job, you want this to be your career, you want this to be the end-all be-all, and it's okay if that's not true. You know, I don't know him too well, but Ryan K. Lindsay, he has a newsletter and he's written about this before, but he's a teacher. He puts out one or two comics a year that he gets a chance to focus on and, you know, put his all into, and he's not doing the grind the same way that Steve Orlando and I are doing, but he's found the iteration of comics that make him happy. I'm a freelance editor for First Second, and I work with a good number of authors who publish one book every 2 or 3 years. They put their all into it, and they're also librarians or nurses or whatever. You know, the goal doesn't have to be writing Spider-Man. You know, statistically, not that many people do that, and not that many people pay their bills in perpetuity doing that. So if your passion in comics is that you want to tell some stories in sequential art, it's okay to not want to be a Marvel or DC exclusive who's pounding out pages every day. It's okay to want different expressions in the field. So I think it's healthy to kind of stop and take stock and remember what it is you're actually trying to achieve. Because all the hustle stuff, you know, it's true no matter what to some extent, but that's especially true when you're talking about those of us who are trying to like make it in monthly comics and keep it going in monthly comics. But comics are a medium and an art form, and there are so many different ways to do that. So don't get discouraged if what you want to do is not necessarily that nose to the grindstone every single day.
Well, as we wrap things up, I have a few final questions for both of you. First, who is your favorite Muppet?
They're not my favorite Muppet, but since they recently had a nice little like non-binary spotlight online, I'm gonna have to give it up to Gonzo for pushing gender norms and gender expectations in whatever Muppets kid show is on right now, because I know they had an episode about Gonzo really wanting a dress and how that's perfectly cool and valid. So good for you, Gonzo. Live your best life. I would love to see you on RuPaul's Drag Race someday, or whatever you want to do. If you want to live at home and with that cockroach or water cockroach, whatever those are called,
they're called Gonzo hangs out with. Toad.
I hope Gonzo has a great time doing that.
Those are not even remotely related. Is it crawfish or tiny lobsters? Crawfish, right? You're such a damn vegan. Anyway, I'm answering this question.
All those animals are just sea cockroaches.
Listen, if it was chili lime, I would eat a real cockroach. So this is like a zero-sum game here. To answer your question, it's hard because it's easy. My initial thoughts as Fox was barely remembering who the Muppets are were the Yippie-Abalians, because it's a noise I generally make in life, or the Swedish Chef. However, the real answer is Statler and Waldorf, perhaps the most me answer possible, because they're just men, old men who complain and hate everything, which is also me in most cases. So I feel very seen by Statler and Waldorf, and those are my answers.
That is our dynamic a lot of times.
Yeah, but I'm both of them, and you're like the Swedish chef now, trying to be happy, and I'm just holds. Trying to throw shit at you from the balcony. Luckily...
No. The Swedish chef is the one Muppet I cannot handle because the human hands are extremely disturbing to me.
I got news for you. There's a human hand in almost every Muppet, buddy, but that's maybe...
as long as it's hidden under felt. We're just trying to keep this an all ages podcast. I can handle it. But watching the, I tried the like latest Disney Plus iteration of the Muppets, and the Swedish Chef was like mushing food together with the human hands, but with the Muppet face, and it really felt like one of those Adult Swim horror shorts that they run at 3 a.m.
Yeah, I was not it's the crossover it well. With the Aqua Teen movie film. Anyway, Christopher, what else do you got for us?
And finally, as I lose it listening to all that, what's your favorite way to consume a potato?
Well, Fox is a vegan, so I'm going to let him answer at least 3 times. And then I will answer once.
I was going to say, there's almost no wrong answer to this. I really like potatoes. I like those potato tornado things where you like cut all the way around it and then pull it apart and like do it that way. I love roasted red potatoes. That's a standard, but a really
listen
good
listen to
one.
How he's getting into put like an ASMR voice as he talks about this too. He's like,
and then I love I mean I really like potatoes, and I'm trying to think, but the basics are standards for a reason.
The golden they're gold standards.
And a nice chunky skin on mashed potato. I'm a skin on kind of guy. I like the texture differences. That's kind of like potato nirvana for me. As long as it's not being prepared by the
being
Swedish
a slob,
chef's
my answer
human hands.
Is that they should be boiled with salt. No, it's actually the answer. The answer is still salt potatoes, but it's actually being from Central New York. They should be skin on and boiled with salt. Which maybe is only a Central New York thing. I don't know, but I crave them so much now that I live in Boston. For the uninitiated, salt potatoes are when you take like fingerling-sized potato skin on, and then you just boil those bastards with a shitload of salt water. Then you serve them with butter and sometimes Parmesan cheese, and it's a very nice thing.
Wait a minute, though. For your Russian,
I was gonna say, I almost made a joke. No,
like
I was almost gonna say it's just an unseasoned
vodka.
Boiled potato. Skin off, which would be the most Russian thing. Like, you cannot have any flavor on the potato. But, like, no, I was trying to give a real answer, Fox. But it's cute that you remember, also as a teetotaler, let me just bury everything about you, that vodka's made from potatoes. You read my Wikipedia, that's adorable.
Actually, every time Steve Orlando visits, we do try to cook something different. We didn't get the opportunity to the last time he was here, but before that, he picked up like fancy mushrooms, and we did
head
it
or chicken of the woods. I don't remember. Yes, despite my ribbing of Fox Steve? Not eating animal products, I'm actually very supportive. I just can't not make jokes. But I do. Yes, we always try to do some sort of cooking project. Yeah, I think we did. I think we did crispy fried hen or chicken of the woods. I can't remember which one it was last time we were there.
I think chicken, because those are more obscure.
Yes, Italy, home of disgraced chef Mario Batali. And now the next thing I want to do is make this vegan Arby's sandwich with you, which I'm real deep into right now.
Chris has discovered that the way to actually get us like really
in the interest of I like these random questions, Chris, you can ask us one more obscure question and we'll probably take 6 minutes to answer it. So by all means.
Okay then. So reloading my random list, the one at the top now is when you put on your socks and shoes, do you go sock, shoe, or sock, sock, shoe, shoe?
I'm actually going to answer first because it's a trick question in my case, much to Fox's disgust. I generally don't wear shoes in a house, and then whenever possible, I also don't wear socks. So other than at the gym, because I'm like a dynamo of heat and it's uncomfortable for me. So that's also why it's shocking that Fox and I are friends, because he would leap out of a third story window to get away from a bare human foot. But everything I just said is true. Everything I just said is true. That said, though, two socks. When I am forced to accept social norms and wear them, both socks go on first.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of feet, which Steve knows and tries to torture me with. They're
I would have thought they were below his hands,
Swedish chef's
but that's
hands
just me.
On things that freak me out.
Hey,
but I am.
Does
I'm
anybody
also a sock,
do the
sock,
other thing? Does any
sock shoe?
Does anybody Whenever do the I, other one? Wait, no, Chris, sock, do sock, you shoe, do shoe. The other way?
I don't do the other one. I actually got a bunch of questions from a Reddit thread of questions to get to know people. But I don't actually know anybody who does sock shoe.
I mean, I've never thought there was anybody that actually put the toilet paper so that the I almost swore there, so that the end of the roll faces away from the outside. I didn't know anybody
actually
did that.
They do that when they reload it at work, and it's horrible, and
yeah.
I hate it.
Well, I didn't know anybody did that until my boyfriend moved in, and now we're like in a cold war over the goddamn toilet paper. Because I don't even know how to reach it. Like, you have to like do a reach around on the toilet paper pole, and I don't do that for free, so it presents a lot of problems for me. But yeah, some of these questions, I'm kind of like, who is the focus group for these things? It's like, oh, do you eat oysters by sucking them out of the shell, or do you put the whole thing in your mouth and spit the shell out like it's a Looney Tune eating a chicken wing? Like, nobody does that. I mean, statistically, some person does it. There's 7 billion people in the world. But this is fascinating to me. I find out more about what humans do from learning what I don't do in questions like this.
Honestly, the only time I've ever seen anybody do sock shoe is like parents putting
sometimes when
stuff
I go
on
running.
Their kids.
Yeah, but then those kids have no sock agency, though. I don't know if we can count that.
See,
but
I was
anyway,
going to say,
no
once in a while... Once in a while, when I'm about to go on a run, I have found myself putting on sock shoe, and it feels viscerally wrong. Like, the moment it's done and you've got one foot completely dressed and one foot not at all dressed is just a creeping
sure
under
not
the skin sensation of not rightness.
First of all, it totally is. Everything
level.
About either of us,
like
in both
feet.
Cases, is always at a pathological level. I'm not just going to make this about you. I just nearly had to jump out my own office window because I had to wear headphones for the first time in 18 months. I assume that you put on your shoes while looking straight ahead, much like I used to do when getting checked for scoliosis back in the day. And you just hope that they appear tied correctly at the end of the experiment. That's.
I just had my butler do it.
A mean thing to call your boyfriend, but anyway.
You know my boyfriend, and if I asked him to put my shoes on for me, he
no,
would laugh
he'd,
me
he
out.
He would
of
shove them so
the
far
county.
Up your ass, you'd look like fucking Alec Baldwin in Beetlejuice. You'd be wearing those Fenty motherfuckers right on your face.
This whole section's gonna have to get cut.
I love getting censored, though, because, you know, people imagine I'm saying something much worse. I could be like tit fart, and like, you know, if you censored it, people would assume I said something really terrible. So, by all means, I'm continuing to cultivate by the blue collar queer of comics, Steve Orlando, who swears and watches wrestling and has opinions. So, come at me.
Okay, this is the last random question, which I just thought of all by myself, and it's all because of you, Steve Orlando. In real life, if you could have a sensor beeping noise that everybody could hear, what would it be?
I'd be Brian Blessed opening a present for me.
I recently switched, so I wake up, I have four alarms set up.
Pathological.
In the morning,
anyway,
and they
go
all
on.
Have different songs.
You're a monster, but okay.
It's a staggered wake up. And before they were just all kind of like instrumental openings, but I switched one of them to Hounds of Love by Kate Bush, which opens with someone saying very dramatically, like, it's in the woods, it's in the trees, it's coming. So the first couple days, I just woke up, like, in a panic of, like, what's coming? What's in the trees? So I think I would choose that sound excerpt to bleep all of my uncouth speakings. So there's a British
we
guy being shot
British
by
fans,
something.
By the way, for folks who don't know that Brian Blessed is British, he is.
It's just classier.
Brian Blessed is pretty classy, man. He has an actor and adventurer in his Wikipedia page, and he didn't write it himself.
Well, it has been great talking to both of you about all of this. If people want to hear more from you, whether in this vein or in a comics vein or any other vein, where else can they find you around the internet?
I am at Steve_Fox, F-O-X-E, on Twitter and on Instagram. Instagram's pretty much just dog pictures, though, which you may want after reading Rainbow Bridge. And also at stevefox.com if you just want to get sort of a clean roundup of everything I'm writing and everything I've got coming up.
I'm at the Steve Orlando on Twitter and on Instagram. And that's where you should go, because... that's where I'm most active. I'm on Facebook, but it's mostly for personal stuff. So I direct you all to my Instagram and Twitter, which are both at the Steve Orlando.
And as always, we will have links to that stuff down in the show notes, because clicking links is so much easier than trying to spell things. As always, if you want to hear more from me, the best place to do that is to head on over to Twitter, where you can find me at Play Comics Cast, doing everything except my day job during the day. That's not true. If anybody at work listens to this, please don't tell my boss, because it's not true, and I will deny it. And he knows I can fake it, make it look like I'm doing this during the day. So, yeah. If you want to help support the show, you can head on over to playcomics.com/support, where I have all kinds of ways where you can help support the show, one of which being Patreon, where for just $1 a month, you can get, I'm going to call it like 95% plus of the episodes early. This one not included, because I finished editing it the night before it came out, super late, and I just am not putting it out early because I'm a horrible, horrible person. If you want to hear some good people, though, head on over to GettingGeek.com, where you can check out all kinds of other wonderfully geeky shows. If you like the music that I'm rudely talking on top of, you can head on over to SoundCloud.com/best-day to check out Best Day's music. But most of all, just grab a game, grab a stack of comics, grab your pet, because you know you love the ever-loving shit out of them. Give them a big ol' hug, and find yourself a new favorite character.
Listen, if it was chili lime, I would eat a real cockroach, so this is like a zero-sum game here.